For the man who, he said, among the ancient philosophers, said something about this very cause that seemed to me, at least as judge, more plausible than anything else, Hecateus of Abdera, says that those taking wives invite many guests to the feast, so that many people will know and can testify that both parties are free-born and marrying free-born partners. For, on the contrary, the comic poets mock those who marry with lavish and ostentatious splendor of dinners and preparation, as not entering the union securely or confidently, as Menander says to the man who urged him to fence in a face with stewpots. Terribly, that is no matter befitting a bride. But so that we may not seem, taking the easiest course, to be finding fault with others while saying nothing ourselves, I declare first, he said, that no occasion for a feast is so conspicuous and widely known as that of a wedding. For people can conceal from many of their friends the fact that they are sacrificing to the gods, or seeing off a friend, or entertaining a guest. But the wedding table has as its accuser the wedding hymn shouting loudly, and the torch, and the flute, things Homer mentions, and the women standing at the doors to marvel and look on. Since, therefore, no one is unaware of the reception and the invitation, people are ashamed to leave out any of their close friends and relations and those connected to them in any way, and so they invite them all. When we had accepted this, Theon took it up and said, let this too stand, for it is not implausible, and add this as well, if you like, that such feasts are occasions not only for friends but for kinsfolk, since another kind of intimacy becomes mingled into the family. And what is more important than this? When the households of two families come together into one, the party receiving takes on the relations and friends of the party giving, and the party giving takes on those of the party receiving, and each, thinking it their duty to show goodwill, doubles the scope of the reception. Moreover, many, or most, of the wedding rites are carried out through the agency of women, and where women are present, it is necessary that the men be brought along as well. At Oedipus in Euboea, where the hot springs form a naturally beautiful place, well furnished for liberal pleasures with lodgings and living quarters, a common resort of Greece has been established. And though many creatures both winged and land-dwelling are caught there, the sea provides no less a well-stocked market, nourishing noble and abundant fish in its clear and steeply shelving waters. The place flourishes most when spring is at its height, for many people arrive there at that season and spend time together in every abundance and pass most of their leisure in conversation. When Callistratus the sophist was present, it was hard work to dine anywhere else, for his good fellowship was irresistible, and the pleasure of gathering all the agreeable people together in one place was one he provided very often. For he often imitated Cimon of old, entertaining many guests of every sort gladly. But he most often, one might say, imitated Cellius, who is said to have been the first to establish a daily gathering of men of good repute and virtue, and to have called it a prytaneum. Conversations fitting for such company naturally arose on each occasion. And once the tables, having become extremely varied, gave rise to an inquiry about relishes, whether the produce of the land or that of the sea is more suitable. And while almost all the others were praising the produce of the land, numerous and varied and hard to enumerate by kind and by difference, Polycrates, addressing Symmachus, said, but you, being a creature of both shores and reared amid so many seas as surround your sacred Nicopolis, do you not take Poseidon's side? I certainly wish to, by Zeus, said Symmachus, and I enlist you too and call upon you, since you enjoy the sweetest things of the Achaean Sea. Well then, said Polycrates, let us first go over to our usual practice. For just as though there are many poets, we call one alone preeminently, the poet, the best of them, so too, though there are many relishes, fish alone, or most of all, has come to be called opsin, the relish, because it surpasses all others by far in excellence. For indeed we call people fish-eaters and fish-lovers, not those who delight in beef, as Heracles did, who ate green figs along with his meat, nor the fig-lover such as Plato was, nor the grape-lover such as Arcesilaus was, but those who show up regularly at the fish market and are quick to hear the bell. And Demosthenes says of Philocrates that with his trader's gold he bought harlots and fish, reproaching the man for gluttony and self-indulgence. And Ctesiphon, not badly, when some glutton in the council chamber was shouting that he would burst, said, by no means, fellow, make us fish-eaters. And the man who wrote the little verse, "Living on capers when you could live on Seabase," what does he mean by it? And what do most people mean in heaven's name when, urging one another to have a pleasant time, they say, "Let us dine on the shore today"? Do they not thereby declare that a dinner on the shore is the most delightful thing, as indeed it is? Is it on account of the waves and the pebbles that anyone, dining on the shore, seasons his meal with a flask of oil and capers? Rather, it is because the table by the sea is well supplied with abundant, fresh fish. And indeed, the produce of the sea is sold, contrary to all reason, at the highest price of all. At any rate, Cato, not exaggerating but speaking the plain truth in a public speech against the luxury and extravagance of the city, said that fish sold for more in Rome than cattle did. For they sell a small jar of it for a price for which not even a prow-horned hecatomb of oxen, once slaughtered, could be bought. And yet the best judge of the power of drugs is the most medically skilled person, and of the excellence of songs the greatest music lover, and so too of the excellence of relishes the greatest fish lover. For it is not Pythagoras, surely, nor Xenocrates, that one should consult as arbiter in these matters, but Antigorus the poet and Philoxenus the son of Eryxis, and the painter Androsides, who they say, in painting Scylla, rendered the fish around her with the greatest passion and vividness because of his own love of eating fish. As for Antigorus, King Antigonus, standing beside him in the camp as he was boiling a pot of conger eels with his cloak girt up, said, "Do you really suppose that Homer, when he was writing down the deeds of Agamemnon, was boiling conger eels?" And Antigorus answered him not badly, "And do you suppose that Agamemnon performed those deeds of his by prying into who in the camp was boiling a conger eel?" "These things," said Polycrates, "I offer as my contribution, both to you and, by Zeus, to the fishmongers as well, drawn from witnesses and from common usage." "But I," said Symmachus, "will approach the matter seriously and in a more dialectical fashion. For if a relish is that which sweetens one's food, then the best relish would be that which is most able to sustain one's appetite for bread. Just as the philosophers called the hopeful school declare that hoping is the most sustaining thing in life. Since, hope being absent, life is not endurable even when nothing else is lacking to sweeten it. So too we must reckon as sustaining that appetite for food without which all nourishment becomes graceless and hard to take. Now among the products of the land you will find nothing of this sort, but among those of the sea, salt comes first, without which practically nothing is edible. Indeed, even bread itself is made sweeter by having salt mixed into it, which is why Poseidon shares a temple with Demeter, and why, among other relishes, salt is the sweetest relish of all. The heroes, at any rate, being accustomed to a plain and simple diet, like ascetics in their way of life, and having stripped away from their food every added and superfluous pleasure, so much so that they made no use even of fish while encamped by the Hellespont, still could not bear to eat their meat without salt, testifying that this alone among relishes is indispensable. For just as colors need light, so flavors need the savor of salt in order to stir the sense of taste. Otherwise, they strike the palate as heavy and nauseating. For corpses, as Heraclitus says, are more fit to be thrown out than dung, and all flesh is a kind of corpse and of a corpse's part. The power of salt, coming upon it like a soul entering in, adds to it both charm and pleasure. That is why people take first, before the rest of their food, the pungent and salty items in general, whatever has partaken most of salt, for these become love charms to whet the appetite for the other dishes, and the appetite, once lured on by them, approaches the rest fresh and eager. But if it begins from those other dishes instead, it quickly gives out. So salt is a relish not only for food, but also for drink. That Homeric line, "On onion, a relish for one's drink," suited sailors and oarsmen better than kings. But foods lightly salted, for the sake of good flavor, make every kind of wine sweet and smooth to the taste, and every draught of water agreeable and invigorating. Whereas the unpleasantness and harshness the onion produces has no share in this at all, rather it disperses the rest of one's food and hands it over compliant and softer for digestion, adding the graciousness of a relish together with the potency of a medicine, once salt has been applied to the body. Moreover, the other delicacies of the sea, besides being most pleasant, are also the least harmful. For though they are meat, they do not weigh one down in the same way, but are digested and dispersed easily. Our friend Zeno here will bear witness to this, and Kraton too, by Zeus, who bring the sick, before all other foods, to fish, as the lightest of relishes. And it stands to reason that the sea should rear bodies healthy and well-conditioned, if indeed it also gives off to us an air that is fine and pure in its lightness and clarity. Well said, replied Lamprias, but let us philosophize on the subject a little further. My grandfather used to say, mocking the Jews each time, that the most righteous meat is the one they do not eat. But we shall say that the most righteous relish is the one that comes from the sea. As for these land creatures, even if nothing else were just about them, still they are nourished on the same food as we are and take the same air, and have baths and drink such as we have. And when we slaughter them, we feel a certain shame, since they let out a plaintive cry, and most of them have been made familiar to us and reared alongside us in our way of life. But the race of sea creatures is entirely alien and foreign to us, as though born and living in some other world. Neither their look nor their voice nor any service they might render pleads against our eating them, for there is nothing one could make use of in them while they are alive, since in our world they do not live in any sense we recognize at all. Nor is any affection for them called for, but this place we inhabit is a kind of Hades to them. For the moment they come into it, they are dead at once. When this had been said, and some wished to argue the opposite case, Callistratus, heading off that other argument, said, What do you all think of what was said about the Jews, that they do not eat the most righteous meat? Amazing, said Polycrates, and I am further puzzled whether the men abstain from eating the pig out of some honor for the animal, or out of loathing for it. For what is said among them resembles myths, unless perhaps they have some serious reasons that they simply do not divulge. Well then, said Callistratus, I think the animal is held in some honor among the men. Even if the pig is misshapen and coarse, it is no stranger in appearance, nor more graceless in nature, than the dung beetle, the vulture, the crocodile, and the cat, which the priests of the Egyptians, some one animal and some another, treat as most sacred. They say the pig is honored for a worthy reason. It was the first, they claim, to break open the earth with the projecting part of its snout, and so give an impression of plowing, suggesting the work the plowshare would later do. Whence, they say, the tool itself got its name from the pig. The Egyptians who farm the soft, low-lying parts of the country have no need of a plow at all. Rather, when the Nile recedes after soaking the fields, they follow behind and drive the pigs onto them, and these, by trampling and rooting about, quickly turn the earth over from below and bury the seed. One should not be surprised, then, if for this reason some people do not eat pigs, when other animals receive still greater honors among the barbarians for even flimsier reasons, some indeed quite ridiculous. For instance, they say the shrew mouse was deified by the Egyptians because it is blind, on the theory that darkness is older than light, and it is said to be born from mice in the fifth generation, at the new moon, and further, that its liver shrinks during the moon's disappearances. They associate the lion with the sun, because alone among clawed quadrupeds, it is born with its eyes open, and it sleeps only the briefest span of time, its eyes gleaming even as it sleeps. And fountains shaped like gaping lions' mouths send forth their jets, because the Nile brings fresh water to the fields of Egypt when the sun is passing through Leo. They say the ibis, as soon as it is hatched, weighs 2 drachmas, the very weight of a newborn child's heart. And by the spread of its feet in relation to each other, and to its beak, it forms an equilateral triangle. And why should one blame the Egyptians for such excessive unreason, when it is recorded that even the Pythagoreans revere the white cock, and among sea creatures abstain especially from the red mullet and the sea anemone, while the Magi, followers of Zoroaster, honor above all others the land hedgehog, but hate water rats, and consider whoever kills the most of them beloved of God and blessed. I think the Jews too, if they truly abhorred the pig, would kill it, just as the Magi kill the rats. But as things stand, killing it is forbidden to them just as much as eating it. And perhaps there is some reason in it. Just as they honor the donkey because it revealed a spring of water to them, so too perhaps they revere the pig because it became their teacher in sowing and plowing. Unless, by Zeus, one will also say that the men abstain from the hare because they loathe the animal as foul and unclean. Not so, said Lamprias, taking up the point, Rather, they spare the hare out of their fondness for the creature it most closely resembles. The text here is uncertain. For the hare, in size and bulk, seems to be a somewhat diminished donkey. Its color, its ears, the sleekness of its eyes, and its skittishness are wonderfully alike, so that nothing so small has ever resembled something so large. Unless, by Zeus, in keeping with these resemblances, those who Egyptianize also hold the swiftness of the creature to be something divine, along with the precision of its senses. For its eye never tires, so that it even sleeps with its eyes open. And it seems to excel in keenness of hearing, which the Egyptians so admired that in their sacred writing they represent hearing by drawing a hare's ear. The men seem to treat pork as taboo because barbarians especially loathe scaly skin conditions and leprosy, and believe that such afflictions creep over people through contact with things of this kind. And indeed, we observe that every pig, under the belly, is covered with scaly eruptions and scabby outbreaks, which do seem to spread over their bodies once some corruption and decay has taken hold in the flesh. Moreover, the very murkiness of the creature's way of life carries a certain baseness in it, for we see nothing else so fond of mud and of filthy, unclean places, setting aside those creatures whose very birth and nature are rooted in such things. They also say the eyes of pigs are so bent and drawn down within their sockets that they never lay hold of anything above them, nor ever look up at the sky, unless, while being carried on their backs, their pupils undergo some unnatural reversal. That is why the animal, though otherwise most given to squealing, falls silent whenever it is carried in this way, and is struck dumb, awestruck by the unfamiliar and overpowering sight of the heavens, held back from crying out by fear. And if we are to bring in the mythical material as well, it is said that Adonis was killed by a boar, and they hold that Adonis is none other than Dionysus, and much of what is performed at the festivals of each confirms this account. Some say he was Dionysus's beloved boy, and Phanacles, a poet of love, writes something to this effect, aware of his divinity. Adonis, roaming the mountains, Dionysus seized and carried off, journeying to holy Cyprus. Symmachus, taken aback at what had been added, said, "Do you then, Lamprias, enroll your ancestral god, the reveler, rouser of women, blooming amid the frenzied honors of Dionysus, and smuggle him in among the secret rites of the Hebrews? Or is there really some account that shows this god to be the very same as that one?" Moiregenes broke in and said, "Leave him be, for I, being an Athenian, will answer you myself and say that he is none other." Most of the evidence for this can only be spoken and taught to those among us who have been initiated into the full triennial rite. But what can be recounted in ordinary speech is not forbidden among friends, especially over wine, when the subject is the gifts of the god. And if these gentlemen ask it of me, I am ready to tell it. When all urged and pressed him, he said, "First, the timing and manner of their greatest and most complete festival befits Dionysus. For keeping what is called the fast, at the height of the vintage, they set out tables heaped with every kind of fruit, under tents and huts woven mostly from vine branches and ivy, and they call the earlier part of the festival tabernacles. A few days later, they celebrate another festival, called not through riddles, but outright the festival of Bacchus. There is also among them a kind of festival of branch carrying and thyrsus carrying, in which they enter the temple bearing theisy. What they do once they have entered, we do not know, but it is likely that what takes place is a Bacchic revel. For indeed they use small trumpets to call upon the god, just as the Argives do at their festival of Dionysus, and others go before them playing the lyre, whom they themselves call Levites, whether the title comes from Lysias or, more likely, from Euias, one of the god's names. I think, too, that the festival of the Sabbath is not entirely unconnected with Dionysus. For even now many call the Bacchants Sabbai, and utter this very cry when they hold their revels for the god. And confirmation of this one can get, I suppose, both from Demosthenes and from Menander. And it would not be unreasonable for someone to say the name was formed from a certain frenzied agitation that possesses those caught up in Bacchic ecstasy. They themselves bear witness to this account by their own practice, when they honor the Sabbath, inviting one another above all to drink and take wine. And when something more pressing prevents it, they consider it proper at least to taste unmixed wine. These things, one might say, are plausible enough. But the strongest evidence against those who oppose this view comes, first of all, from the high priest, who leads the way at their festivals wearing a mitre and clad in a fawnskin sewn with gold, wearing besides a robe reaching to his feet and buskins. And many small bells hang down from his garment, jingling as he walks, just as they do among us. And they use such sounds at their nighttime rites and call the nurses of the god bronze clashers. And the thyrsus carved into the pediment opposite the temple bears this out, along with the drums, for these belong to no other god than Dionysus. Furthermore, they do not offer honey in their sacred rites, because they believe it spoils the wine when mixed with it, and honey itself was once, before the vine appeared, both the libation offering and the intoxicant. And even now, those barbarians who do not make wine drink a honey wine instead, tempering its sweetness with wine-like, astringent roots. And the Greeks likewise pour these same sober, honey-mixed libations, on the ground that honey's nature stands most opposed to that of wine. And that they hold this same belief is confirmed by no small sign, that among the many punishments in use among them, one in particular is held in special disgrace, namely, the one that bars those being punished from wine for as long a time as the one in charge of the punishment prescribes, and those thus punished. Here the rest of the fourth book is lost. Concerning the pleasures of the soul and of the body, Sosius Senecio, I for my part cannot tell what opinion you now hold, since many shadowy mountains and the sounding sea lie between us. Yet long ago you seemed not entirely to agree with, nor to approve of, those who hold that the soul has nothing of its own that is pleasant or delightful or in any way desirable, but simply lives alongside the body, sharing in its smiles and again its frowns at whatever the body experiences. As though it were a mold or a mirror, receiving the images and reflections of the sensations that arise in the flesh. For this unlovely doctrine is caught out as false on many grounds, and not least by the fact that at drinking parties the witty and cultivated men, as soon as dinner is over, turn at once to conversation, as though to a second table, and delight one another through discourse, pleasures in which the body shares nothing, or scarcely anything at all, thereby bearing witness that the soul has some private storehouse of enjoyments laid up for itself, and that these alone are pleasures belonging to the soul, while those others are foreign to it, merely tinging it through its contact with the body. Just as nurses who spoon-feed infants share only a little in the pleasure of it, but once they have satisfied the children and lulled them to sleep, freed at last from their crying, then, on their own, they take suitable food and drink for themselves and enjoy it. So too the soul shares in the pleasures of drinking and eating, serving the body's appetites the way a nurse does, indulging its needs and soothing its desires. But whenever the body is content and at rest, freed from its business and its servitude, the soul thereafter turns to pleasures of its own, feasting on discourse and learning and stories, and on the search to hear something out of the ordinary. And what need is there to say more on this, seeing that even coarse men with no love of letters, after dinner, turn their thoughts to pleasures quite removed from those of the body, proposing riddles and puzzles and word games hidden in numbers. For this same reason mimes and character actors and Menander and his imitators have found a place at symposia, since these remove no pain from the body, nor produce any smooth and pleasant sensation in the flesh, but rather because the love of spectacle and of ideas that is natural to each person's soul seeks out its own particular delight and enjoyment, once we are freed from attending to and caring for the body. On these very matters conversation once took place, with you present, in Athens, at the time when Straton the comic actor had his great success, for there was much talk of him then, when we were dining as guests of Boethus the Epicurean, and dining together with us was, not a few of that school. Then the mention of comedy turned the discussion, as though among lovers of learning, to an inquiry into the cause. Why is it that when we hear people's voices as they rage, or grieve, or fear, we are distressed and made uneasy, while those who act out these same passions and imitate their voices and dispositions give us delight? Now of all those present, there was almost one opinion. They said that since the one who imitates is superior to the one who genuinely suffers and differs from him precisely in not having suffered, we take pleasure and rejoice in perceiving this. But I, though setting foot, so to speak, in another man's chorus, said that since we are by nature rational and lovers of art, we are favorably disposed toward whatever is done rationally and skillfully, and we admire it whenever it succeeds. For just as the bee, being a lover of sweetness, attends to and pursues every substance in which anything honey-like is mixed, so man, being by nature a lover of art and of beauty, is disposed to welcome and embrace every product and object that partakes of mind and reason. If, at any rate, one were to set before a small child, side by side, a small loaf of bread, and alongside it, a little dog or ox molded from the same flower, you would see him drawn toward the latter. Likewise, if one man were to offer plain silver coin, and another were to hold out and give a little silver figurine or a cup, the child would rather take the object in which he perceives craft and reason mingled in. This is why children of that age take more delight in riddling speech and in games that involve some intricacy and difficulty, for by nature, untaught, the mind is drawn toward what is subtle and cunning as toward its own kin. Since then, the person truly angry or truly grieving is seen amid certain common passions and movements shared by all, whereas in mimicry, a certain cleverness and persuasiveness is displayed, provided the imitation succeeds, we are by nature disposed to delight in the latter and to be pained by the former. And indeed, we experience the same thing in the case of spectacles. We look with distress upon people actually dying or painfully ill, but we gaze with pleasure upon the painted Philoctetes and the sculpted Jocasta, into whose face, they say, the craftsmen mix some silver, so that as the figure of the human being failed and wasted away, the bronze might take on a pallor, we take delight and admire it. This too, I said, gentlemen Epicureans, is strong evidence for the Cyrenaics against you, that the pleasure we take in things heard and seen resides not in the sight or in the hearing, but in the mind. For a hen crowing continuously, or a crow, is a distressing and unpleasant sound to hear, yet one who imitates a crowing hen or a crow delights us. And we are displeased to look upon consumptive men, yet we gladly gaze upon statues and paintings of the consumptive, because the mind is led by the imitations according to what is proper to itself. For what did people undergo, or what external experience befell them, that made them so admire Parmenon's so as to become proverbial? And yet they say that when Parmenon had won renown for his mimicry, others, in emulation, tried to compete against him in display. And since people, already prejudiced and set in their opinion, kept saying, "Good, but nothing compared to Parmenon's sow," one man, taking a little pig under his arm, came forward, and when they, hearing the true sound itself, still murmured, "Well, what is this compared to Parmenon's sow?" He let the piglet loose into their midst, thereby exposing that their judgment was directed at reputation, not at truth. By this above all, it is clear that the same affection of the senses does not dispose the soul in the same way, when there is not attached to it the opinion that the thing is being accomplished rationally or ambitiously. At the Pythian games there arose discussion about the additional contests, to the effect that they ought to be abolished. For having admitted the tragic actor alongside the three established from the beginning, the Pythian flute player, the lyre player, and the singer to the lyre, as though a gate had been thrown open, they could not hold back the crowd of all sorts of performances that pressed and forced their way in together. Through these the contest gained a variety not unpleasing and a festive character, but it did not preserve its austerity and its musical purity, and it caused trouble for the judges, and, as was likely, much ill will from the many who were defeated. Not least did people think it necessary to remove the tribe of prose writers and poets from the contest, not out of hatred of learning, but because, being by far the most well-known of all the competitors, people felt embarrassed before them and were troubled, considering them all men of talent, though not all could win. We then, in the assembly, tried to soothe those who wished to alter the established order and who charged the contest, as though it were an instrument, with having too many strings and too many voices. And at dinner, while Petreus the games director was entertaining us, when similar talk arose again, we came to the defense of music. We declared that poetry was not a late or recent arrival at the sacred games, but had long since won crowns of victory there. To some, I seemed likely to serve up stale fare by bringing up the burial rites of Oulichus the Thessalian and of Amphidamas the Chalcidian, at which they say Homer and Hesiod contended in verse. But I set that aside, since it has been thoroughly worn out by the grammarians, along with the readings recited at the funeral games of Patroclus by some as not Haemonas, but Remonas, as though Achilles had proposed prizes for speeches as well. Letting that go, I said instead that when Acastus his son buried Peleus, he too provided a contest in poetry, and that the Sibyl won it. When many pressed me and demanded the authority for so incredible and improbable an account, I happily recalled and pointed out that Acesander records this in his work on Libya. And this reading, I said, is not one that is generally accessible. But as for the work of Polemon the Athenian on the treasuries at Delphi, I think many of you make a point of reading it, and rightly so, for he is a man of wide learning and never nodding off in matters of Greek history. There, at any rate, you will find it written that in the treasury of Sicyon there was dedicated a golden book, an offering of Aristomach of Erythrae, who had twice won the Isthmian Games with an epic poem. Nor, indeed, I said, is it right to be so awestruck before the Olympic Games, as though they were an unalterable and immovable fate among athletic contests. For the Pythian Games have included 3 or 4 additional musical contests, whereas the athletic contest has for the most part remained fixed from the beginning as it was established. At the Olympic Games, everything is an addition except the foot race. Many events, too, having been introduced, were later abolished, such as the race of the mule cart and of the wagon. The crown for boys in the pentathlon was likewise done away with, and in general, many innovations have been made regarding the festive. I am afraid to say that in ancient times, a contest of single combat used to be held near Pisa, carried through to the death and slaughter of the defeated and those who fell, lest you demand of me again the authority for this account, and should the name escape my memory over wine, I become a laughingstock. The question was raised about the pine, on what account it became the wreath at the Isthmian Games. For the dinner was in Corinth, the Isthmian Games being held, and Lucanius, the high priest, was entertaining us. Praxiteles, the guide, then, brought up the mythical version, that the body of Melicertes was said to have been found washed ashore by the sea against a pine tree. For indeed, not far from Megara, there is a place called the Fair Course, through which, the Megarians say, Ino ran to the sea carrying the child. It is commonly said by many that the pine is Poseidon's own crown. But Lucanius added that since the plant is also consecrated to Dionysus, it is not without reason associated with the honors paid to Melicertes. And this very point raised the question by what reasoning the ancients consecrated the pine to both Poseidon and Dionysus. It seemed to us that there was nothing strange in this. Both gods are held to be lords of the moist and generative principle, and nearly all the Greeks, one might say, sacrifice to Poseidon as nourisher of plants and to Dionysus as of the trees. Not but that one might say the pine belongs particularly to Poseidon, not, as Apollodorus thinks, because it is a coastal plant, nor because, like the sea, it loves the wind, for some say this too, but chiefly because of shipbuilding. For it, and its kindred trees, the fir and the stone pine, supply the most seaworthy timber, along with pitch and resin for caulking, without which the fastened planks are of no use at sea. To Dionysus, the pine was consecrated because it sweetens the wine. They say that pine-covered regions produce vines that bear sweet wine grapes. Theophrastus attributes this to the heat of the soil, for the pine grows generally in clay ground, and clay is warm, and so it helps to ripen the wine, just as clay also yields the lightest and most pleasant water. Furthermore, when mixed with grain, it also increases the yield abundantly, ripening and swelling the wheat by its heat. But it is also likely that the vine itself benefits from the pine, which has great suitability for the preservation and durability of wine. For with pitch everyone coats their vessels, and many mix in resin with their wine, as do the Euboeans among the Greeks, and among the Italians, those who dwell around the Po. And from the region of Vienna in Gaul, the resinated wine is brought down, held in especially high esteem by the Romans. For such additions not only impart a certain fragrance, but also make the wine drink easily, quickly removing by their heat the rawness and wateriness of the young wine. When this had been said, the one among the orators who seemed most given to reading works of a liberal education said, "By the gods, was it not only yesterday, so to speak, that the pine here became the crown of the Isthmian Games, when formerly they were crowned with wild celery. This one may even hear from the mouth of some miser in comedy, saying, I would gladly sell the Isthmian prize for whatever the celery crown fetches. Antimius, the historian, records that when the Corinthians were marching to fight the Carthaginians on behalf of Sicily, some men happened to bring in, not celery, but, and when the majority took this as an omen and not a good one, since celery is thought to be associated with funerals, and those dangerously ill are said to need celery, Timoleon encouraged them and reminded them of the celery at the Isthmus, with which the Corinthians crowned their victors. Further, the flagship of Antigonus, which sprouted celery of its own accord around its stern, was named Isthmia. And this riddling inscription clearly attests a jar stuffed with celery. It is composed thus: the dark earth, black earth burnt by fire, conceals the dark blood of the god Dionysus, bearing Isthmian sprigs about its mouth. "Have you not read this?" he said. "You who honor the pine as though it were not an import, not something new, but the ancestral and time-honored crown of the Isthmian Games." He thus stirred up the young men, as a man of wide reading and much learning would. Lucanius, however, looking at me and smiling at the same time, said, "By Poseidon, what a wealth of learned quotation." But others among us, it seems, benefited from their ignorance and lack of erudition, persuading the opposite, that the pine was the ancestral crown of the games, and that from Nemea, in rivalry, the celery crown intruded as a foreign newcomer, on account of Heracles, and having prevailed, eclipsed the pine as being a fitter sacred emblem. But then in time the pine recovered its ancestral honor, and now flourishes again in esteem. I, for my part, was persuaded and gave my attention, so that I learned by heart and remember many of the testimonies, Euphorion, for instance, speaking somewhat as follows about Melicerts. Weeping, they laid the boy down among the pines of the shore, at the time when they are borne along in contests for crowns. For not yet had the rough grip of hands mown down the child of the moon, the grim one, beside the mother of Esopus, from the time when they cast thick celery about their temples. And Callimachus makes it still clearer. For Heracles says to him concerning the celery, and to him the sons of elites, holding a contest much older than this one beside the god Aegeon, will establish as the token of Isthmian victory, in rivalry with those from Nemea. And they will dishonor the pine, which formerly crowned the contestants at Ephra. Further, I believe I have come across the writing of Procles, who records concerning the Isthmian games that they set the first contest for a crown of pine. But later, when the contest became sacred, they transferred to it the celery crown from the Nemean festival. This Procles was one of those who studied together with Xenocrates in the academy. To some of the fellow diners, Achilles seemed ridiculous, forbidding Patroclus pour the wine more unmixed, and then adding such a reason as, "For the men dearest to me are beneath my roof." Nicratus, then our companion the Macedonian, flatly maintained that it was not unmixed but warm that was meant by Zoron, deriving it from life-giving, Zodican, and from boiling Zesus, a view which, he claimed, made good sense, given that with the men's companions present, a fresh bowl was being mixed from the start. For we too, whenever we are about to pour a libation to the gods, make a freshly mixed bowl. Sosicles the poet, however, recalling Empedocles' statement that in the universal transformation, things once unmixed become Zora, said that the word Zoron was used by the man to mean the well-tempered rather than the unmixed, and that there was nothing to prevent Achilles from urging Patroclus to prepare the wine tempered for drinking. And if, instead of Zoron, he said Zorotrin, this was no more strange than Dexiterin for Dexion, right hand, or the Lyterin for Thelios, female, since it is common usage to employ the comparative in place of the simple form. Antipater, our companion, however, said that in the archaic manner years were called horae, and that the prefix za commonly signifies magnitude, hence wine of many years was called Zoron by Achilles. I, for my part, reminded them that by Zorotrin some understand hotter to be signified, and by hotter, quicker, just as we ourselves often urge our attendants to set about their service more briskly, hotter. But I declared their zeal to be somewhat boyish, since they were afraid to admit that Zorotrin meant more unmixed, as though Achilles would thereby find himself in some awkward position, as Zoilus of Amphipolis supposed, not realizing first that Achilles, knowing that Phoenix and Odysseus, being older men, delighted not in watered wine but in the stronger mixture, as do other old men, bids the mixture be made stronger. Then again, being a pupil of Chiron and not inexperienced in matters of bodily regimen, he no doubt reasoned that for bodies unaccustomed to idleness and leisure, a looser and softer mixture is fitting. And indeed it is not without reason that celery is thrown in among the other fodder for horses, but because horses that are kept idle, contrary to their custom, suffer harm in their feet, and of this, celery is the best remedy for this. Indeed, you would not find any other fodder compared with the horses in the Iliad besides celery, or anything of that sort. But Achilles, being a physician for the horses as well, took care of them appropriately for the occasion, just as he prepared the lightest diet for the body, as being the healthiest one while at leisure. But he did not think it right to prescribe the same regimen for men who had spent the day in battle and contest as for men at leisure. He ordered the mixture of their wine to be made stronger. Moreover, Achilles does not appear to be naturally fond of wine, but rather harsh in temper. He was not, after all, a sweet-tempered or gentle man, but very impetuous. And speaking frankly of himself somewhere, he says, "I have lain awake through many sleepless nights." And a short sleep does not suffice for those who drink their wine unmixed. When reviling Agamemnon, the first thing he calls him is heavy with wine, as though putting forward drunkenness as the chief of diseases. For all these reasons, then, there was good ground for him to reflect, once those men had appeared, whether the mixture of wine customary for him might be too weak and ill-suited for them. The oddity apparent in the matter of seating arrangements gave rise to further discussion at the receptions which each of our friends held in entertaining us on our arrival from Alexandria. For many people were always invited, those who were thought in any way to have some claim to be included, and the parties had a turbulent character, both in their general conduct and in their hasty breaking up. But when Onesicrates the physician invited to dinner not many guests, but only his closest and most intimate friends, it seemed to me that what Plato said, "A city that grows too large is no longer a city," held true of a dinner party as well. For a symposium's size is sufficient only up to the point where it is still willing to remain a symposium. But if it exceeds that through sheer numbers, so that it is no longer sociable with itself, nor sympathetic in its friendly exchanges, nor familiar, then it is no longer a symposium at all. For one ought not to make use of messengers, as in an army camp, nor of bosuns calling out orders, as on a trireme, but the guests should converse with one another directly. Just as in a chorus, the man at the edge keeps in tune with the leader when the whole symposium forms a single chorus. When I had said this, our grandfather Lamprias spoke up in the midst of the company and said, "Do we then need self-restraint, not only with regard to the dinners themselves, but also with regard to the invitations? For there is, I think, a kind of intemperance even in hospitality, when it passes over none of one's acquaintances, but drags all of them along as though to a spectacle or a recitation. As for myself, it is not the running short of bread or wine for the guests that makes the host look ridiculous, so much as the running short of room and space. For it is with regard to these things that an abundance ought always to be kept ready even for uninvited guests and strangers who happen to arrive unexpectedly. Moreover, when bread and wine run short, it is possible to blame the servants for having pilfered them, but a scarcity of room and a using up of it through overcrowding is a kind of contempt on the part of the host himself. And Hesiod is admired with good reason for saying, "First of all things chaos came to be, for space and room needed to exist beforehand for the things that were to come into being, not as though the party were made up, as my son said yesterday, of the Anaxagorean phrase, all things were together." Even so, when there is room enough and preparation enough, the crowding together itself must still be guarded against, as making the company unsociable and unapproachable to one another. For to take away the sharing of wine is a lesser evil than to take away the sharing of conversation from a dinner. That is why Theophrastus, joking, used to call the barbershops wineless symposia, because of the chatter of those who sit there. Those who cram many people together into the same place do away with the sharing of conversation, or rather they make it possible for only a few to converse with one another. For people pair off in twos or threes and talk and converse with each other, while those reclining farther off they neither know nor even look at, being separated by a horse's course, both to the tents of Ajax son of Telamon and to those of Achilles. Hence the rich do not act rightly when they show off youthful bravado in building dining halls fit for 30 couches or more. For such preparation belongs to unsociable and unfriendly dinners, requiring a director of a public festival rather than a symposiarch. Yet that behavior may be excused in them, since they consider wealth to be no wealth at all, indeed truly blind and unproductive, unless it has witnesses, just as tragedy needs spectators. But for us, the remedy for bringing many people together at once would be to invite them frequently in small groups instead. For those who entertain rarely and, as the saying goes, once in a blue moon, are forced to write down every acquaintance or connection whatsoever, however remote. Whereas those who invite people more often, taking up three or four at a time, make their dinner parties light, like ferry boats. And a further means of separating out the great crowd of one's friends is a continuous reckoning of the occasion's purpose. For just as, for our various needs, we do not summon everyone, but only those suited to each particular need, calling on the prudent when we take counsel, on eloquent speakers when we go to court, and when traveling, on those who are lightest to bear the practical burdens and have the most leisure. So too in receptions one must on each occasion select those who are suitable. Suitable companions for a governor giving a dinner are the magistrates, if they are friends, and the leading men of the city. But at weddings, or at birthday celebrations, those related by family and sharing in the household Zeus. And at such receptions, or at send-offs, one must gather together above all those most cherished by the persons being honored. For when we sacrifice to a god, we do not invoke all the other gods together in our prayers, even those who share his temple and his altar, but rather, when three mixing bowls are being mixed, we pour a libation to some from the first, to others from the second, and to others from the last. For envy stands outside the divine chorus. And the company of friends is likewise, in a sense, divine, when it is distributed with good judgment in social gatherings. When this had been said, the discussion at once turned to the question of the cramped seating at the beginning of a dinner, and its subsequent loosening. The opposite of what one would expect to happen as a result of the fullness produced by the meal. Some of us then blamed the posture of reclining, arguing that people, for the most part, recline broadly while dining, since they stretch out their right hand toward the tables. But after dining, they turn over more onto their side, making the shape of the body a narrower one, and no longer, so to speak, lying flat, but occupying, along a line, only the edge of their space. Just as knuckle bones take up less room when they fall standing upright than when they fall flat, so each of us at first leans forward onto our stomach, looking toward the table, but later shifts our reclining posture from breadth into depth. But most of the company put forward instead the yielding of the couch's bedding, arguing that, being pressed down during the reclining, it spreads out and gives way, just like well-worn shoes, which, gradually giving and loosening at the seams, provide roominess and freedom of movement for the foot. And the old man, joking at the same time, said that one and the same symposium has two dissimilar overseers and leaders. At the start, Hunger, who has no share in any tactical skill, and later Dionysus, whom everyone agrees to have been the best general there ever was, just as Epaminondas, when certain generals, through inexperience, led the phalanx into some difficult terrain where it fell into confusion and became entangled in itself, took it in hand and disentangled it, and set it back in order. So too Dionysus, the looser and leader of the dance. Taking us up at the start, all huddled together by hunger like a pack of dogs, arranges us into a cheerful and sociable order. When talk arose at dinner concerning the practice of casting the evil eye, and of certain people having a bewitching eye, the rest of the company entirely made light of the matter and laughed it down. But Mestrius Florus, who was entertaining us, said that the actual occurrences remarkably support the common report, but that the lack of an explanation makes people unjustly disbelieve the account, given that, though countless things plainly exist, the explanation for them still eludes us. And in general, he said, the person who seeks a rational explanation for everything strips away all sense of wonder from every case. For where the explanation for a cause fails, that is precisely where inquiry begins, that is to say, philosophy, so that, in a sense, those who disbelieve wondrous things do away with philosophy altogether. One must, he said, pursue the question of why something happens by reasoning, but accept that it does happen on the evidence of report. And many such things are indeed reported. We know, for instance, of people who harm infants most of all by staring down at them, because the infant's constitution, being moist and weak, is turned and driven for the worse by them, while solid and already set constitutions suffer this less. And yet Philarchus reports that the people who live around the Black Sea, formerly called the Thebans, are deadly not only to infants, but even to grown adults. For those who come into contact with their glance, their breath, and their speech waste away and fall ill. And it seems that the mixed-blood peoples who came to buy slaves from that region noticed this effect. But of these phenomena, one is perhaps less astonishing, since touch and direct contact upon the skin has some evident beginning of an effect. And just as the feathers of other birds, when set alongside those of the eagle, are destroyed, wearing away and shedding as their plumage rots, so it is not at all out of keeping that a human touch too can be in one case beneficial and in another harsh and harmful. But that people should be harmed by merely being looked at happens, indeed, just as I have said, yet it is disbelieved because the cause is hard to track down. And yet, I said, you yourself have in a way found some trace and pathway of the cause, by arriving at the effluences given off by bodies. For smell and voice and the current of the breath are certain emanations of living creatures, and parts of them that set the senses in motion, whenever people are affected by their falling upon them. And it is far more likely that such things are given off by living creatures because of heat and motion, since the breath possesses a kind of pulsation and agitation, by which the body, being continually struck, sends forth certain effluences. And this is most likely to happen especially through the eyes. For sight, being highly mobile and accompanied by breath that sends out a wondrous fiery radiance, disperses a remarkable power, so that a person both suffers much and does much through it. For a person is affected by moderate pleasures and displeasures arising from things seen, and of the passions of love, which are indeed the greatest and most violent affections of the soul, sight supplies the beginning, so that the lover flows and melts, as it were, when he gazes upon beautiful people, drawn toward them as though pulled. For this reason, one might especially wonder at those who suppose that a person is affected and harmed through sight, yet no longer believe that a person can act and cause harm through it. For the mutual glances of those in their prime, and whatever issues forth through the eyes, whether it be light or a current, wastes away and destroys lovers, along with a pleasure mixed with pain, which they themselves call bittersweet. For neither by touch nor by hearing do people suffer wounding and affliction in the way that they do by looking and being looked at. For such a transmission and kindling occurs from the sight that those who marvel at media naphtha catching fire from a distance, because of flame should be regarded as entirely inexperienced in love. For the glances of the beautiful, even when exchanged from quite far off, kindle a fire in the souls of lovers. And indeed, we often hear reported the remedy for those suffering from jaundice. By gazing upon the charadrius bird, they are cured. For this creature seems to have such a nature and constitution that it draws in and receives the affliction as it issues forth, like a current, through sight. And this is why the charadrius birds do not look at those who have jaundice, nor can they endure it, but turn away and keep their eyes shut, not out of envy, as some suppose, of the cure that would come from them, but as though wounded by a blow. And of other diseases, those who spend time with sufferers most readily and quickly catch ophthalmia in particular. So keen a power does sight possess to communicate and to implant in another the beginning of an affliction. And indeed, said Patroclus, you speak rightly, at least as regards bodily matters. But as for the affections of the soul, among which is the casting of the evil eye, in what manner and how does it transmit harm through sight to those who are looked upon? Do you not know, I said, that the soul, when it suffers, brings the body into a corresponding state? For thoughts of sexual desire arouse the genitals, and the fury of dogs in their contests against wild beasts often extinguishes their sight and blinds them, while griefs and avarice and jealousies change the complexion and waste away one's physical condition. And of none of these is envy less apt, by its very nature, to lodge in the soul and to fill the body too with its wickedness, which painters do well to attempt to capture when they sketch the face of envy. So then, whenever people so disposed by envy fix their gaze upon others, and their eyes, being positioned nearest to the soul, draw up the evil from it, and, like arrows dipped in poison, fall upon their victims, I think nothing strange or incredible occurs if they affect those they gaze upon. For even the bites of dogs become more severe when they bite in anger. And they say that the seed of men takes hold more readily when men approach in the act of love. And in general, the passions of the soul strengthen and render more vehement the powers of the body. This is also why they believe that the class of so-called amulets against fascination is of help against envy, since the strangeness of their appearance draws off the gaze, so that it presses less heavily upon those affected. Let these, I said, Florus, be reckoned as the contributions to the feast. And Sacclara said, only if we first put them to the test ourselves, for there is something in the argument that appears spurious. For if we take as true what many people say about those who are bewitched, you surely are not unaware that some suppose even friends and relatives, and some even fathers, to possess a bewitching eye, so that women do not show their children to them, nor allow them to be gazed upon for long by such people. How then will this affliction still seem to be a matter of envy? And what, by Zeus, will you say about those who are said to bewitch themselves? For you have heard of this too, and if not, you have certainly read the lines. Fair once were they, fair, the locks of Eudolidas, but a baleful man, seeing himself in the whirl of a river, bewitched himself, and at once an unseemly sickness seized him, for Eudolidas, they say, appearing handsome to himself, and suffering something because of the sight, from that moment fell ill and lost both his good condition and his beauty. But consider how you can find arguments to explain such oddities. Otherwise, I said, not very adequately, but drinking, as you see, from so large a cup, not without boldness. I say that all the passions, once they have remained in souls for a long time, produce evil dispositions, and these, once they have acquired, set in motion by whatever occasion presents itself, often carry people down, even against their will, into their own habitual passions. Consider how cowards fear even the things that would save them, how the irritable grow harsh even toward those dearest to them, and how the lustful and licentious end by being unable to keep away even from the most sacred of bodies. For habit is powerful in drawing one's disposition toward what is familiar to it, and a person who is precariously balanced is bound to stumble against everything he meets. So it is no wonder that those who have formed within themselves an envious and bewitching disposition are moved, in keeping with the particular nature of that passion, even against their own kin. Moved in this way, they do what their nature compels, not what they wish. For just as a sphere is bound to move spherically and a cylinder cylindrical, owing to the difference in their shape, so a person's envious disposition moves him enviously toward everything. Yet it is also likely that such people look more intently at what is their own and what they love, and that is why they do it more harm. As for the excellent Eudolidas and all those said to bewitch themselves, I think it is not unreasonable that this happens to them. For according to Hippocrates, being at the very peak of good condition is precarious, and bodies that have advanced to the height of their prime do not stay there, but incline and sway toward the opposite. So whenever people make a sudden gain in condition and see themselves looking better than they expected, so that they marvel at and closely study the change in their body, they come close to being carried by their own condition toward the worse. That is, to bewitching themselves. This happens more from the currents that arise when people stand before water or other reflecting surfaces. For the current breathes back upon the very ones looking, so that they are harmed by the same means with which they used to harm others. Perhaps the same thing, happening also with children, often falsely lays the blame on those who merely look at them. When I had finished, Gaius, the son-in-law of Florus, said, "But Democritus's images, like the men of Egem or Megara, get no reckoning or regard at all." He says these images, which issue from envious people, are not wholly without sensation or impulse, and are filled with the malice and bewitching power that comes from those who send them out. And that, becoming implanted with this malice, remaining, and taking up residence with the people who are bewitched, they throw them into confusion and harm both their body and their mind. That, I think, is more or less the man's meaning, though he expresses it in marvelously grand and elevated language. Quite so, I said, but I am surprised you failed to notice that I said nothing else about these currents except to strip them of anything animate or purposive. Precisely, so that you would not think I was conjuring up phantoms for you late into the night, sentient, thinking images meant to frighten and unsettle you. Let us then, if you agree, examine this further in the morning. Once, when we were dining in Caronia and every kind of fruit had been set before us, one of the guests reclining at table happened to recite the line, "Sweet fig trees and apple trees of splendid fruit, and luxuriant olive trees." The question then arose why the poet applied the epithet of splendid fruit specifically to apple trees. Tryphon the physician said it was said by comparison with the tree itself. Though the tree is quite small and unimpressive to look at, it produces fruit that is beautiful and large. Someone else said that the apple alone among tree fruits displays beauty composed of every element together. It is clean to the touch, so that it does not soil the hand, but fills whoever touches it with fragrance instead. Its taste is pleasant, and it is most delightful to smell and to see. That is why, engaging nearly all the senses at once, it is reasonably praised. We agreed that these explanations were reasonable enough. But since Empedocles had written, "Wherefore pomegranates are late born, and apples overflow their rind," we understood the epithet applied to pomegranates to mean that, since autumn is already ending and the summer heat dying away, they ripen their fruit late. For their moisture, being weak and viscous, cannot be brought to solidify by the sun unless the air begins to turn colder. Which is why Theophrastus says this is the only tree that ripens its fruit better and faster in the shade. But as to what Empedocles the sage meant by calling apples hyperfloia, we were at a loss, especially since the man was not in the habit, for the sake of fine writing, of decorating things with the most attractive sounding epithets, as if with bright colors, but of making each epithet reveal some underlying substance or property. As when he calls the body that surrounds the soul, the earth enveloping mortal man, calls the air cloud gathering, and calls the liver full of blood. When I had said this, some of the grammarians present said that apples were called hyperfloia because of their peak ripeness, since the poets used the word floine for being exceedingly in bloom and flourishing, and that Antimachus, in much the same way, spoke of the city of the Cadmeans as blooming with fruit. And likewise that Aratus, speaking of the dog star, says, "Some things it strengthened, but of others it destroyed all the bloom," using flues for the greenness and blossom of fruits. And that there are even some Greeks who sacrifice to Dionysus under the title phloios, the budding one. Since, then, of all fruits the apple most retains its greenness and bloom, the philosopher called it hyperfloion. But our grandfather Lamprias said that the prefix hyper signifies not only excess and intensity, but also on the outside and above. In this sense, we call a lintel hyperthyron and an upper room hyperoon. And the poet calls the outer flesh of a sacrificial victim, hupertera, just as he calls the inner parts enchata. Consider then, he said, whether Empedocles rather coined the epithet with this in mind, that whereas other fruits have their outsides enclosed by a rind and bear on their surface what are called husks, shells, membranes, and pods, the apple's rind lies on the inside, a sticky, oily membrane to which the seed clings, while the edible part surrounds it on the outside. It was therefore reasonably named hyperfloion, having its rind turned outward. After this, a question was raised about figs, why such a rich, sweet fruit should grow from so bitter a tree. For even the fig tree's leaf, on account of its roughness, is called thrion, and its wood is full of sap, so that when burned it gives off very pungent smoke, and once reduced to ash, its lye is the most effective of all for cleansing, owing to its sharpness. And most remarkable of all, while every other plant that sprouts and bears fruit also blossoms, the fig tree alone bears no blossom. And if, as they say, it is never struck by lightning, one might attribute that too to the bitterness and poor condition of its trunk. For lightning bolts seem not to touch such things, just as they do not touch the hide of the seal or of the hyena. Taking up the discussion, the elder among us said that whatever sweetness is present in the plant is all squeezed together into the fruit, so that it is only reasonable that what is left behind becomes sharp and unmixed with sweetness. For just as the liver, once its bilious element has been separated off into one place, itself becomes very sweet, so the fig tree, releasing all its rich and savory quality into the fig, is itself left with no share of sweetness. And that the wood does share in some good quality after all, he said, I take as evidence what the gardeners report. They say that rue growing beneath a fig tree, planted alongside it, is more pleasant and milder in flavor, as though benefiting from some of its sweetness, so that its usually heavy, overpowering pungency is tempered. Unless, by Zeus, the opposite is true, and the fig tree, drawing off the rue's nourishment for itself, is what removes its sharpness. Florus, when we were dining at his house, raised the question of who might be meant by those of the salt and the bean in the proverb. Apollophanes the grammarian resolved this readily on the spot. Friends close enough, he said, to dine together on nothing more than salt and bean are what the proverb refers to. We then puzzled over how salt came to be held in such honor, since Homer plainly says, he sprinkled it with divine salt, while Plato says that salt, by human custom, is the substance most beloved of the gods. The puzzle was sharpened further by the fact that the Egyptian priests, when observing ritual purity, abstain from salt altogether, so that they even eat their bread unsalted. For how could they treat as forbidden something beloved of the gods and divine? Florus told us to set the Egyptians aside and address the question in Greek terms. I replied that even the Egyptians are not really at odds with the Greeks here. Their purifications also exclude procreation, laughter, wine, and many other things otherwise worth pursuing. Salt, perhaps, they avoid while keeping themselves pure because, as some say, its heat stimulates one toward intercourse, and it is also likely that they avoid it simply as the most pleasant of relishes. For salt is very probably the relish and seasoning of all other relishes, which is why some call it the graces, since it makes what is necessary in our food pleasant. Is that then, Florus asked, why salt is called divine? That, I said, is indeed no small part of it. People tend, for the most part, to deify what is common and pervades their needs, as with water, light, and the seasons, and the earth they take to be not merely divine but a god outright.